This is the Bill Hallacy interview for March 31st, 2007.
This is Anthony Young calling.
Yes.
Would this be a good time to speak with you then?
Yeah, just a minute. Let me get to my desk.
Okay.
Anthony, who are you representing? A corporation or a company? Or just what are you doing?
Okay. I'm an author, and my publisher is a company called Springer Praxis. Springer is very well known for its scientific journals, and Praxis publishes specialized aerospace titles, history titles, and so forth. You can find them on the web. I've personally been writing for 30 years now, and my most recent book is on the history of the lunar roving vehicle and some of the upcoming rover concepts, as well as there was a chapter devoted also to the Mars Exploration Rover program. And this is my second book for Springer, and actually started doing some research on this some months ago. Of course, your name has come up. I'm familiar with your interview with Dr. Lundquist out at the university.
Okay.
But that interview was, of course, an overview. And what I'm trying to do, Bill, is to get, I've always emphasized oral history in terms of relating aerospace history. I'm familiar with, of course, Roger Bilstein's book, Stages to Saturn. But my goal has always been to try to interview people directly involved with the program and get them to relate their experiences working on specific programs, in your case, the S1C stage. And what I also do, as I did with Sonny Maria when I interviewed him for my Lunar Rover book, as well as others, is to give them a copy of the chapter where their comments are quoted so they can see what is said in context, and they can make any changes they want. I've always done this, and find people always appreciate it, and they like knowing I'm getting my facts right. So, actually, I'm going to be up there in Huntsville in a few weeks, but I wanted to catch you now if I could and have you talk about your experiences working on the Saturn first stage program. But want to back up a little bit. I made some notes watching Dr. Lundquist's interview with you and see if you could fill in some blanks for me.
Okay.
There. He did mention that you did start working on the Jupiter program. But I didn't get too much in the way of details on that. How did you get involved with that program out at Marshall?
My real experience started on Jupiter with Chrysler Corporation.
Yes.
I hired in with Chrysler right out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And did some work on the Jupiter. Came to Huntsville as part of a management training program, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed with Chrysler, about 4 years, I guess, with some military experience in between, primarily on the Jupiter, and then switched over to the Army when Marshall Space Flight Center was formed to kind of backfill the void caused by the transfer of most of those workers from the Army into to NASA.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm familiar with that transition.
Mm-hmm. So that transition also for the Jupiter, the Army had been ordered to give that system to the Air Force.
Oh, I was unfamiliar with that. Okay.
And the transfer was being on the Air Force side was being handled down at Brooklyn Air Force Base in Mobile.
Okay.
So during that time, another fellow and myself would commute really to Mobile to interface with the Air Force folks down there. Once that transfer was complete and we shut down the Army Jupiter office here in Huntsville, then I switched over to NASA.
Okay, how did that Of course, you were in Huntsville, so you were familiar with people working there and so forth. But how did you learn and arrange for that transfer?
Well, primarily, I just contacted some folks and told them, hey, I was ready to come to work for NASA.
Okay. What was your first program contact there? I mean, not an individual, but I mean...
Program contact?
Yeah, what...
I moved into Propulsion and Vehicle Engineering Laboratory.
Oh, yes, okay, I understand, yes.
Mm-hmm. In VE Lab. And I worked in a vehicle integration group for one of the guys.
I'm looking at the organization chart for Marshall about that time. It's called the Propulsion and Vehicle Engineering Division.
Division, okay.
William Mrazek.
Mrazek was the laboratory chief.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Leland Ballou was... in charge of the engine management office.
Through my whole career, did not really work directly with the engine folks.
Okay, yes.
We interfaced with them because they supplied the engines, obviously, for the S1C.
Well, what were your duties in the engineering division, the propulsion and vehicle engineering division?
I headed up a group that was doing some... let me see specifically what was it.
Was it Saturn I related at all?
No, it was primarily Saturn V, getting ready, doing some of the preliminary Saturn V work.
Okay.
Which of course did involve some Saturn I, 1B activity.
Okay.
And worked primarily with, there was about three or four different contractor organizations that was in that office at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I only stayed there for a short period, like 6 or 8 months.
Oh, I see. Okay. How did you get turned on to the first stage program then? How did that come about? Did that transition into that?
Well, when I worked on the Army side, backfilling for the folks that left to go to Marshall, was working with a guy by the name of Matt Erloff.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And Matt had already transferred over to NASA, to Marshall. So when it came time for me to look other places, I got a hold of Matt, and I asked him if he needed some good folks.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, at that point in time, then I switched over and started to work for Matt in the S1C office.
What I want to establish with, because I'm going to have specific chapters devoted to certain aspects. There's an F1 engine aspect of this book, but also an S1C stage aspect, because really the engine and the first stage were a system. And so I'm dealing them in separate chapters, but as a whole, if you understand what I'm not discussing the whole Saturn V vehicle. That's already been dealt with, but I just want to be specific with that aspect of it. And I want to make clear that, would you say that the S1C stage really was almost entirely designed at Marshall prior to Boeing, the contract negotiations?
Well, The initial design, yes. I say that very, very carefully because
mm-hmm.
when Boeing was brought on board and Boeing was given the full design manufacturing responsibility for the first stage, they went through the whole design and revalidated for their own purpose, because they were now taking responsibility. They validated that design. But yes, primarily the design was done at Marshall, but it was done in conjunction with some of the Boeing folks.
Okay, good. I needed to understand that. So When you came into the, was the S1C stage considered a separate office?
Yes, S1C project office.
Okay. And you reported to Matt Erlob then, is that right?
Yeah, Matt, M-A-T-T.
Yes.
Matt Erlob, yeah.
So your duties then involved what? Because I know you were involved in contract negotiations, but you're not really, you weren't really working on the engineering side. You were...
No, primarily I was what they call a project control chief.
Okay.
The project control office was responsible for the contract, for the budgets and schedules, et cetera. The non-engineering side.
Okay. I have interviewed Bill Sneed, and I guess you are one of those people that he spoke of that were involved in... since they were the overall Saturn V program office, that you actually handled the contract negotiations with Boeing.
Yes.
Can you remember when you started that? Because I understand that they there's always a selection process, a request for proposals and or bids or whatever, before a contractor is selected, in this case for the S1C. I'm plumbing the depths here, but can you remember?
Well, the initial contract was where the selection was made, and that was done while I was still over on the Army side.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I did not participate in what they call source selection on with Boeing. After I came over to Marshall, then we did a lot of contract modification work. And we switched the type of contract. If you're familiar with contracting types, we went from a cost plus fixed fee contract to a cost plus incentive fee contract. And that in itself was a major undertaking because it was kind of the first of its kind within the agency.
Yes. Sonny Maria was telling me that for the LRV program that came much later, that's precisely the kind of, I think your that form of contract did pioneer the kind of contract they drew up with Boeing for the LRV eventually.
Uh-huh.
Yes, that approach. I want to be able to relate that, and I imagine these contract negotiations took place in Huntsville, or did you go to Michoud? Because that was the manufacturing facility.
Yes, both places. We did it wherever the we felt necessary to do it.
What kind of the back and forth, what was it that, first of all, you had to get Boeing to agree to that, I assume, to that particular contract arrangement?
Contract?
Yeah.
We had to get them to agree to it, but it was a mandated thing, so there's not much choice. It was just how you went about implementing, and that took quite a bit of convincing, if you will. But we finally, obviously, came to an agreement as to the contract conditions and how we were going to operate, and who was going to be responsible for what, and that was a major issue in getting the agreements with Boeing is getting that responsibility line clearly defined, because as you indicated, Marshall did the initial design and now you were handing it over to a contractor. And contractor's going to be kind of leery of that, because are you going to continue to be in his pants, or are you going to give him the full responsibility? So yeah, that was kind of a delicate set of negotiations that we went through to make sure that both parties were in full agreement with the final result.
Well, my experience in during my research is that Marshall was very much, very closely involved with every contractor to make certain that whatever they were contracting for was a product that had the reliability that they wanted, so forth, and that some contractors took umbrage with that. They had a hard time dealing with that, but that's always the way Marshall operated, and I assume
that's correct. That was the philosophy of the center, that even though the contractor had full responsibility. Marshall Space Flight Center was going to perform a major oversight of what was going on, and we were going to delve very deeply into the operation, especially because of that type of contract, where it's a cost-plus type of contract.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marshall never really took for granted the delivered product to be what they wanted. They always had a very thorough test validation for flight program once these stages were delivered anyhow.
Well, yeah, as part of this agreement with the Boeing Corporation that I went through, I wanted to use the basis for acceptance of the hardware from the contractor, what I call the contract end item specification, CEI spec is what they call it. And the vehicle would go through a checkout, a very detailed checkout before being accepted by the government. And I kind of indicate, and I didn't indicate, that's the way we ended up negotiating, that it had to pass 100% all of the tests in order for the Boeing company to get their incentive fee that was set aside for that particular vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very hard thing for them to accept as well, but they finally did accept it.
And I'm sure these acceptances took place at Michoud?
That hardware acceptance was at Michoud.
Okay.
On their hardware that was built down there.
Okay.
Are you aware that the first few ground test stages were assembled here in Huntsville.
That's what I understand. There was a T stage, I think an F stage,
yeah.
Facilities, and then a test stage. And I am familiar. How did those first ones built? How involved was Boeing with these at that point? Do you remember?
Yeah, a lot of the components were assembled in New Orleans and then shipped up here for final assembly here.
Oh, I see.
For instance, a bulkhead.
Yes.
Might have been fabricated at Boeing Michoud because we set the machinery up down there, very expensive machinery to do that. The bulkhead would be shipped up here on a barge and then brought into the assembly building here at Redstone.
Mm-hmm.
And the final welding would be accomplished here. The parts would be shipped in here. So this first few stages, that's why I say the assembly was done here, but the fabrication, the detailed fabrication, most likely, or most of the time, was done at a remote site.
Okay. Once the contract had been negotiated and completed, signed, and the ink dried and all that, what were your day-to-day activities like at Marshall? This was, I assume, in the early to mid-60s. What were your duties then after the contract negotiation was complete?
My duties specifically
were
primarily monitoring the contract, assuring that the contract was meeting the requirements of the contract, and the specifications, the milestones, the what we call the incentive fee features, that he was paying attention to those and was meeting those in order for him to gain his contract completion and his fee for that particular piece of hardware.
Okay, so the incentive fee, there were actually incentive fees, not just one when the vehicle was delivered. There were certain fees applied to certain aspects of the stage, correct?
Right. Uh-huh.
Oh, I see. Okay.
When a stage is delivered, for example, there was a certain amount of fee riding on that. If there was a X amount of what did they call them? I'm not using the right term here. It's there's something not 100%.
Okay.
And the contractor had to go back and fix it. He would get dinged in the fee pool, if you will. He didn't get as much fee as if it had come through the first time 100%.
I see. Okay.
And the stage would go over to the Mississippi Test Facility Once it arrived over there, it went through a static firing successfully with no glitches or no cutoffs or anything. Then there was fee riding on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was fee riding on meeting the specified delivery dates. So yeah, there was different pots of fees, if you will, scattered all through the program.
Okay. What came up during the S1C program that could have thrown or did throw a wrench in the delivery schedules for the S1C that you remember? What issues came up? Because, you know, that S1C was really a very complex stage.
There was a couple of things that come to mind right away. The major engineering problem that arose was a phenomenon called POGO.
I'm familiar with it, but I haven't spoken with anyone that could actually relate what happened. But
well, it's the flow of, this is now from a guy that's been away from it for many years. The flow of the propellants through the propellant lines.
Mm-hmm.
If you're familiar with the stage, what was on top?
The LOX tank was on top of the fuel tank, and they had the five big tunnels.
Yes. Well, those tunnels, as the propellant would flow through those tunnels, you would get a phenomenon down at the engine of a pulsing.
Mm-hmm.
And the engines would start to pulse, and you would start getting what we referred to as a POGO effect. The vehicle would kind of pump up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And that phenomenon we found on one of the very, very first flights. It might have been even the first S1C-1. We found that. And in that major problem, the team of Boeing, and they really went all out. Boeing and the Marshall guys together went to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to give the that was one of I'm at a loss for words today.
I guess
the advantages of having mm-hmm. a company like Boeing, because if they had a particular problem that required a specialty from that they didn't have there, they had the whole resources of their corporation, and they would reach up to Seattle or wherever to pull those people down to help solve these problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that to us was a big advantage. Anyway, that problem was solved for the next flight, and that was it. This problem was solved rapidly because of everybody's involvement to find the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Another minor thing, minor in terms of the functioning of the hardware, we had propellant sensors that are located throughout the vehicle to tell when you get to certain levels of propellant in the tank, depletion sensors and so forth. And there was a major problem arose in those sensors. That sensor was used throughout the whole vehicle on the S2 and S4B as well.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the S1C stage was the only stage that was under an incentive contract. The others were still trying to get from a fixed fee to an incentive and hadn't arrived there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a big demand for those sensors in order to meet delivery of the hardware. I remember specifically because my bosses at Marshall were a little upset that Boeing had gone to the vendor and asked the vendor to give them the first pieces of hardware off their assembly line, and they'd give them a little extra fee for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other contractors were not under an incentive fee contract, and they didn't have that advantage. So Boeing got the first set of hardware in order for them to get it put on the stage and get their stage delivered on time, so that they were assured of getting the maximum fee.
Mm-hmm.
minor problem, but it was one of an interesting situation caused by, the result was caused, it was affected by the incentive contract.
What was your, the Apollo program was a very aggressive program, made a lot of demands on people. What was your work day like? Was it, it wasn't simply 9 to 5 or 8 to 5, was it?
No.
Didn't think so.
No, I, as I recall back then, you know, most of the people were highly motivated.
Mm-hmm.
This was such an exciting thing that we were doing. The goal was very clear. Schedules were very clear in terms of what we had to do. So everybody really rallied around to make sure that for our individual piece of it, we were gonna be there and be there on time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the S1C is of all the stages on the Saturn V vehicle, the S1C is the one that came through with the least number of problems, both from a financial, from a technical, from contract, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
We had the fewest number of hiccups or glitches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what caused that? I don't know. You know, you can say, well, we did a good job, or some would say, well, you had an easy design, or whatever, but that's the way it came out.
Okay. Since you were so close to the test facilities there, did you have an opportunity to see the S1C tested out there at Marshall?
Most of the time, yeah.
What was your first experience like seeing that?
of course, we went from a single engine testing, which was very impressive, to watching a whole cluster of the five F1 engines being fired, and that's just mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to see that and feel it. It's the feeling sensation that really gets to you.
Mm-hmm.
The sight, you know, is one thing, but just to feel the vibration and the shock waves coming off that thing, it's just very impressive to watch the amount of power that's being generated by that thing.
Mm-hmm. During these tests, you mentioned Pogo previously. The issue of Pogo did not come up, if you remember, during these static tests at all?
No.
Ah.
Apparently it was a phenomenon once you released the vehicle, and it was free of being tied down on the test stand or the launch pad.
Mm-hmm.
The phenomenon occurred when the whole thing, like a rubber band, was free to move around.
Okay. Okay. What were your dealings with some other people that you remember quite well that you had to do there at Marshall? You don't operate in a vacuum. You have to work with other people. Who were some of the more, colorful types you had to work with? I spoke with Conrad Dannenberg, and he had a lot to say about Dr. Rudolph, and as well as Bill Sneed having a chance to tell me what it was like to work with Dr. Von Braun and Rudolph. But I don't know what some of your other, for example, Matt Erlob, I obviously won't be able to interview him. I don't know what he was like as a person. But I do have a CD that was transferred from an audio tape of an interview he did.
Oh, is that right?
And I think that was originally done for Roger Bilstein's book on Stages to Saturn. I had the archivist down at Clear Lake in Houston give me an audio copy of that interview, so at least I have that.
Is it just an audio?
Yes, it is. I don't think it's a videotape.
Gosh, I never heard about that one. That'd be interesting to listen to. Matt was a relatively quiet individual. He was not an outspoken type person. Very quiet in the way he conducted his business. He was a damn good project manager. And the test to that was the fact that he was He was the S1C project manager from the beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all the other stages had their project managers replaced.
I see.
His philosophy was, as a project manager, my job is to get rid of my job as soon as I can. People don't recognize that means he's got to successfully turn that product out and then move on to something else.
Yes.
And so from that standpoint, I really learned a lot about project management from that guy. And he pretty much gave his people a free hand to do their work.
Mm-hmm.
The chief of the engineering side of that office was a fellow by the name of Cal Blevins.
Okay.
Cal's still alive. I went to his wife's funeral just a couple of weeks ago. So I know he's still around, and he looks pretty good, although he's getting long in years. He's a World War II veteran.
Okay.
Outside the office, I did a lot of interfacing with Bill Snead, mainly because he was, as you indicated, the program control chief up at the Saturn V level, working for Arthur Rudolph.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Rudolph was a very colorful person, as you've probably heard from everybody. Everybody's got their stories about Arthur.
Any dealings with the even higher ups? Did you have any contact at all with Dr. Von Braun? And
I very little with Von Braun.
How about the meetings? Meetings were conducted weekly there, I guess, on these programs. Did the S1C stage have weekly meetings?
Well, as a project office, we had our weekly meetings, with internally with ourselves and then also with Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
Boeing had a presence in Huntsville, both from the S1C and Saturn V. Of course, they had a Saturn V responsibility. But the meetings that we would have, occasionally we would have meetings with Von Braun, and my recollection of that, of course, is what you've all heard, is he was just a hell of a guy to know and very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
But not often and not directly.
Okay.
Of course, we had meetings with the Saturn V program manager, because we had several of those. And I'm trying to think, one of them was an Air Force colonel. He was here for a while. And then there was an S2 project office manager.
The S2 stage is Art Godfrey and G. Wallace, but I think these are on an engineering.
Yeah, there was an Air Force guy that came in there to try to help out when the S2 was in such problems.
Mm, yes.
But that interface was just when we had meetings with Art Rudolph, and he wanted all the project office people there.
Okay. What was your first experience then that where you actually had to got to witness a launch? Did you go down for 501?
Yes. No. For some reason, one of my guys went down.
Okay.
Ex Navy pilot of mine. That, I don't know. I think he happened to be down there on some business for us. Quote unquote, just happened to be there. Working a financial problem for us with our interface with Kennedy, but yeah, he went down for 501 and gave me a blow-by-blow description of what was going on. My first Saturn V launch was Apollo 8.
Oh, okay.
I was down there when, and to me, that is the most historic launch. Because that was the first time man left the environment of Earth.
Yes, and I read the book that a fellow wrote devoted to just the Apollo 8, because that was a bold decision to begin with, and it was the first. So to go to the moon on the, I think that was the only the third manned flight of the the Saturn V or something like that, some low number like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, very, very low. And but of course, because of the historical significance, I do remember that and Borman's flight. And, but I was at the Cape when that went off, and of course that sensation of the ground vibrating and everything else, and the sight is just fantastic.
Let me back up a little bit here. Do you remember the names of any people at all at Boeing that you worked with during the negotiations or after the negotiations?
Oh, boy.
I know it's been a long time, but...
Yeah. One name that stands out, Henry Runkle, was a bald-headed engineer. He was heading up the engineering group for Boeing. A very capable guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guy that walked into my office one day and said, "Halsey, tell me, who are the guys that can say no around here?" A lot of people say yes, but I just want to, you identify to me the guys that can say no. That was his philosophy. He was going after those people to convince them of a particular solution to a problem.
Okay.
No, I can't off the top of my head. I'd have to do some digging around.
Okay. Well, there are still folks like you in Huntsville that worked on this program, and I'm doing the best I can to find out who they are that were involved with either the F-1 or the S-1C stage.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, of course, you talked to Sonny on the F-1 as well.
I've put together my list of questions for him that he wants to review so he can refresh his memory. So I'll be getting those off to him, but he did give me an excellent interview for the LRV program that's in my book. So,
well, if you've got any detailed questions for me that you'd like, yeah, if you could email and send me or something like that, and I could do some digging and refreshing.
Okay, why don't you give me your email address then, and I'll...
hwhala@AOL.com.
All right. All right, great. I think I've hit basically all my high points here. I appreciate you talking with me today, so I can, I'll work on covering over these points you've covered, and then I'll get back with you with any other questions. I'm going to be up there in a couple of weeks to do my research out at the university. And their archives are excellent out there, I understand. I was there.
Good job, yeah, between the UAH and the Space and Rocket Center.
Yeah, Mike Wright in the history office out there is working to get me approved. I've been out there before, so it shouldn't be a problem. But
when are you planning to be here?
I'll be there from April 8th, Sunday the 8th, through the following weekend. So I'll be there the whole week, and I think Monday and Tuesday I'll be out at the university, and then Wednesday, Thursday out at Marshall History Office.
I'll be here 9th, 10th, and 11th, and then I'm out of town.
Okay. I'm also going to, and I'll finish up with the moon buggy races at the end of the week. I'm sure you're familiar with those.
Yeah, I was the one that kind of got those started.
Mm-hmm.
We I was in charge of the 25th, 25th or 15th. I gotta look up here. This is the 15th anniversary of the first moon landing. We had a big celebration here in Huntsville, and I was kind of in charge of that, and we were talking about, we need to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of this moon buggy race came up, and we turned that over to one of the science guys at Marshall put together some kind of a specification. We sent out all out to the colleges, and I don't know, we had about 8 or 9 respondents. And of all the schools to win that competition that very first year was my college.
Really?
University of New Hampshire.
Yes, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. How about that? Well, it's grown into quite an event now. I went 2 years ago. And I mean, just the parking lots around the Space and Rocket Center are just filled with all these basically these little pavilions where they're either building, fixing, checking. It's almost like a pit area at a race, you know. It's pretty exciting now. They even have the team from Germany and Canada coming this year.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, we had the very first one over on the, Sonny probably told you this, over there where they did the testing of the original LRV over on the side of the arsenal.
Oh, is that right? No, I wasn't familiar with that.
Yeah, there's a section just north, northeast of the, with the end of the runway, where the Redstone airstrip is.
Mm-hmm.
There was an area, I assume it's still there, that was designed to try to simulate the moon.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's where they had the very first moon buggy race.
I see, okay. Let me ask you one final question. Do you have anything at all in your files that of a photographic nature that might show some people that were involved with the program from your end of things at all? Because I have a chapter devoted to that.
The answer is yes, but I'd have to go dig that up.
Okay. Okay. Because I'm mentioning quite a few people here, and trying to get photographs of any of them is pretty difficult from the NASA website, because they just only have the great and the famous there, and the people who really did a lot of the hard work are just I cannot find photographs of. So if you could look through your files there, I'll email you today so you've got my email address, and then you can bounce back and let me know if you found anything.
Okay. Have you touched base with the folks that published the Marshall Star?
No, I haven't. I'm familiar with the publication, but I assume, of course, they're out at Marshall, but...
Well, Mike Wright could put you in touch with them.
Okay.
Because they would have a lot of photographs that they had used over the years. And
yes, that's a good point. I'll write that down. All right. I'll ask Mike about that when I go out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I appreciate you talking with me today, Bill. Got a lot of good information here.
Okay.
When I finish up the chapter where I've quoted you, I can email it to you, and you can just review it at your leisure and let me know if I got my facts straight. Invariably, something is convoluted, and we'll get that straightened out. But this way, I have a little saying, once it's in print, it's forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to avoid any mistakes, because I'll hear about it.
Okay.
When it comes out. So thanks for talking with me today, and hopefully maybe one day I'll get to meet you.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.